morning. Welcome to the Environment and Tourism Portfolio Committee. We are this morning having a presentation on the implementation of the air quality presented by Mr. Without any further ado,
thank you very much, Chair. Thank you very much for this opportunity. Chair, to a large extent, I've prepared a presentation just to basically get the ball rolling and to present myself here to answer any questions that anybody may have. And hopefully this will actually set the scene for and get some interesting discussion going, because the area of air quality is still relatively new, air quality management, and there have been dramatic developments over the last couple of years, and so I just want to keep you abreast of exactly where we are. To start off, I just want to give you a snapshot of typical air quality problems in South Africa, and for that I'm going to use data from the Vaal Triangle Airshed Priority Area. As many of you know, the Vaal Triangle Airshed was the first priority area that was declared as a national priority area in terms of the UN. And this is the information that gives you a baseline on what the problems are in that particular area and the things you have to deal with. With that, just a quick introduction to the Air Quality Act, the key challenges that are associated with that act, the requirements for building sustainable or sustained implementation capacity of the act, because we're aware the act itself is meaningless if it's not to be implemented. Dealing with coordination and cooperation, air quality publications, of which I've given a couple of samples for your edification. And then I'm going to go to key implementation initiatives and a case study if you'd like to have that as well. But that's not necessary, there's more detail about it. So if I can go ahead with your indulgence. In the Vaal Triangle identified, that's the map that you see there with the border around it is the Vaal Triangle Airshed Priority Area. And it encompasses the entire area from Soweto all the way through down to Northern Free State. Basically, it includes two of the most obvious problem areas that have been recognized for many, many years, which is Sasolburg, Sunnyvale Park, and Fremantle as well. From the studies, you can see exactly where we're getting poor air quality. The rings that you see there, the yellow rings, are circles around the areas where we have areas today with poor, one day a year of poor quality. The smaller green circle is where we have 5 days a year, and the blue circle is where we have 25 days a year of poor air quality. And as you can see, there are certain specific hotspots where we have very poor air quality. And when we say poor air quality, there is a strong chance that this is affecting people's health and well-being. The biggest issue in the area is, as in the rest of the country as well, in terms of where we have poor air quality, is still particulate matter, and that's the smoke we see. So in other words, just driving into the airport this morning, there was a brown plume hanging across the bay. That's particulate matter, that's smoke that you can actually see. And this is a major problem. Because of the heavy industries here as well, we also have things like volatile organic compounds from the petrochemical industries and so on and so forth. But what I'm going to do is unpack each one of these areas just to give you an indication of how this looks. The first one, which is Sasolburg, hotspot area number one, is petrochemical hotspot. There is, of course, Sasol, and the National Refinery is based there as well, and a number of downstream petrochemical industries. Now, what I want to draw your attention to is, in terms of these pie charts on the right-hand side of the screen, the pie charts, the row on the left-hand side of the pie chart are the actual emissions, what is being measured and coming out of the stack. The pie charts on the right-hand side are what people are actually breathing. Because the reality, of course, is that many of these stacks are very, very high, and as such are highly diluted. So the stuff that comes out of the stack is not necessarily what people are breathing. So it's just a comparison of the two, because it starts making sense. And as you can see, as you'd imagine, from a petrochemical hotspot, that the majority of the emissions are from the petrochemical industry. coming down to the problem solution, which is the bottom one, the PM10, however, the actual stuff that people are breathing, the amount of stuff that people are breathing from petrochemical industries is relatively small compared to the amount of stuff that they're breathing from the mines. And the reason for that is obvious. Because the emissions from the petrochemical industry are all high, through high stacks, so there's a level of dilution. Whereas the stuff from the mines is dust blown from heaps and haul roads and so on and so forth. And of course, that's in the breathing zone of people, so it's been blown into people's homes. So that's what that looks like. You'll also see from the oxides of nitrogen side, the NO2, that iron and steel processes also are being breathed by people, for instance, in Zandela. In other words, the emissions from places like Sunnyvale Park are being breathed by people in Zandela as well. The next one we turn to is hotspot 2, which is a mining and power hotspot. This is specifically a hotspot that looks at a mine and the Letaba power station operated by Eskom. And hardly surprising, once you get in that area, the emissions themselves are mostly from the power station, as you can see. Except when you start getting out the particulate matter, where the emissions from the mining start becoming quite significant. Once again, and this is interesting of course, is that of the stuff that people are breathing, the impacts of the power station are relatively limited in that area. The bad stuff that people are breathing, certainly in terms of SO2 and the nitrogen, the oxides of nitrogen, are once again from the iron and steel batteries. Then you can start seeing that the impacts from Vereeniging as well, in terms of particulate matter, are as the smaller industries are having an impact. But once again, the significance there is probably around the mines, and also we're starting to get phosphate and fertilizer processes as well from surface. This is Sunnyvale Park. And this is Mittal Steel, Explore Mittal. Most emissions coming from them, and most of the stuff that people are breathing are coming from Mittal. And as you can see, in terms of particulate matter, a lot of the stuff is also from smaller industries. Once again, this is the same situation. The smaller industries, they usually have a lower stack, which means that the pollutants themselves are not being put into higher air streams that will get polluted. They're basically okay around the stack, but if you downwind of the stack, you're going to be breathing in what's coming out of those stacks. This is the Vereeniging area, which is very much a mixed industry hotspot. Also has quite a lot of iron and steel. But as you can see, suddenly the profile changes quite dramatically. The profile here in terms of major emissions around this area is from vehicles. And this is, once again, relatively obvious from our analysis, is because there are a lot of the manufacturing industries around there, and because they're not using rail transport, they're using road transport. So all the steel that has been produced, the cables and what have you, has been transported in a heavy truck through the town. And once again, smaller industries in that area have a major role to play. Then the next hotspot is Orange Farm. And this is very much a residential situation. And you can see in terms of this that the emissions themselves are from domestic fuel burning. This is in this particular area, of course, is the burning of coal. And as you can see, this is the huge air quality challenge that we face, because in essence people are burning coal not because they want to, because it's the only cheap fuel that they actually have. And so therefore the use of the law to control this is especially difficult, because the only way that you could do that is to basically criminalize poverty, which of course is morally repugnant, and I mean it's a cheap law. So governments really have to step in and start making an intervention here. Because in essence, the polluter pays principle can't pay, because the polluter actually here is the person who's also the victim of that pollution. And the same, of course, starts looking the same for Soweto, except that there is a slightly difference in the profile, and that Soweto also has a very high level of vehicle emissions, as opposed to Orange Farm. And once again, I mean, that's also, if one travels in that area, one can see the difference as well, major vehicle emissions in the Soweto area. So that kind of gives you an idea of the kind of air pollution problems, because this is a typical example of air pollution hotspots around the country, of which, in terms of the national framework, which is one of the documents that you would ever see, which was published on February 11, 2007, if you turn to Table 24 of that, you'll see all the municipalities, the district municipalities, that have poor air or potentially poor air. And it's not a huge amount. I mean, we basically got 25 around the country, mostly in hotspots like this. And with that, you can quite easily sort of say that as a country as a whole, we don't have a dramatic air pollution problem. However, we have hotspots like this where there are real problems, where people's health and well-being is being affected by pollution. So this was the Air Quality Act, what it's all about. It is one element of an entire new approach to air quality management. It's the regulatory element of that, which of course you pass. And why I say it's not an end in itself, because there are a whole bunch of structures around it that have to be put in place to make sure that it's properly implemented and so forth, and a whole bunch of mechanisms that have to be put in place to make sure that the implementation is effective. And I'll unpack a number of those as well. The Act was actually developed relatively quickly. It was produced and brought into effect exactly 4 years after the first concept document, which was a technical concept document. And as yet, the licensing sections of the Act have not been brought into effect. The reason for that simply being is that the licensing activities are undertaken by the municipalities. So in this period now, we're in the process of actually building a capacity of municipalities to actually do the licensing. Until we're quite satisfied that they're able to do that, the National Department still licenses the scheduled activities, which are basically the most significant industrial sources of pollution. In terms of the Act that you passed, this is the kind of comment that we received, and once we passed from Professor Harold Anagon, who's one of the leading experts in air quality management in the country. And basically saying that the Act that we have in place is in line with the most modern international trends in terms of air quality management. And the reason being is that what it is an objective-based approach. It's not a case of just purely managing what comes out of a sack. It's actually managing the air that we breathe, which of course is directly linked to our constitution. So if one puts a spin on Section 24 of our constitution, it will say that we all have a right to air that is not harmful to our health and well-being. And that's what the Act does. In terms of the key challenges of the Act, first of all, I mean, the Act provides a number of tools and what have you, but once again, there are a number of challenges that have to be faced, and one of them, which is the obvious one, is a political challenge to a large extent. And in passing the Act, I mean, the political challenge is well faced. Because up until the passing of the new Act, our legislation was from 1965, the old Atmospheric Pollution Prevention Act. And the reason why nothing changed on that Act is simply because there was this fallacy that proper air pollution control reduced industrial development. In fact, the actual opposite is true. If one considers things like the South Durban Basin, which is a pollution hotspot, it's not poor air pollution management that is causing reductions in any investment in that area. It's poor air quality that is causing reductions in investment. In other words, if the existing industries actually manage their air properly, there'll be far more space for development. But as it stands, local communities will stand up against any major development in that area. Which is going to be an interesting challenge for us, even though there have been dramatic reductions in pollution in that area, in terms of what happens to the land that is now occupied by the Durban airport. What happens to that in terms of development afterwards. The aspect of residential wood and coal burning as well is, once again, an issue of poverty. And as I mentioned to you, that is a challenge that cannot be met in law. It needs government to actually make interventions to actually provide alternatives and to do a number of things. And of those, the department has actually got the mandate from other departments to actually lead a process to start building up a residential air pollution strategy. For the simple reason that, as it stands at the moment, poor people spend more on energy in terms of percentage-wise than middle-class or rich people. And for a number of reasons. In terms of our houses themselves, they're not insulated, so they're particularly hot in winter, in summer, freezing cold in winter, which means that to warm up a house, you need far more energy if you're poor than if you were rich. The situation, of course, is the choice of fuel, of course, is normally the most available and cheap fuel, and if, for instance, it can be found for free, for instance, like the chopping down of trees or anything like that, then, of course, that's the fuel to be used. In the high fault region where there is coal availability. Coal is used, and it's normally brown coal, it's normally poor credit grade coal as well, with a very high particulate content. So when you burn it, there's lots of smoke. And the traditional way of burning it in Lola would be that you fill up a drum with coal. When you light the fire, fire starts going, you fill it up with coal, and basically it starts smouldering through the thing. It produces a huge amount of particulate matter, and also actually mobilizes volatiles from the coal itself. So we have to find ways and means of, first of all, looking at better fire-making practices, start looking at the sort of situation in terms of building the thermal efficiency of low-cost houses, and providing alternatives, but also starting to look at the other aspects, for instance, tree planting to actually reduce dust volumes and what have you. Because you can imagine, trees themselves act like filters. If you have a township development that has not a single tree, if a small wind goes through it and there's dust rose, the dust just goes straight into people's homes. However, if you have some greening, some trees, the trees themselves pull out a lot of dust. And study has shown how dramatically trees can actually reduce that particulate matter, which is a major problem. In that, you can see that one of the challenges there, of course, is that the fossil fuel burning in the country as it stands costs the nation $4 billion a year of healthcare costs. That's because of respiratory diseases and so on and so forth. And therefore, our motto has been with the municipalities themselves is that an investment in proper air quality management is an investment in public health. There is a measurable reduction. Unfortunately, to actually have that measurable reduction, our statistics around air quality and our statistics around health have to be linked. And that's in part because it's challenged. Because many issues, many of them can actually list the air pollution related diseases. But we have a number of interventions now trying to look at a situation where we can actually start this linkage, where health, which really is the real measure of proper air quality, is used as the indicator. The other key challenges in terms of the Act, and I'm going to rush through these very, very quickly, is that I'm just going to quickly map out six areas of capacity that government requires in order to implement the Act effectively. And when I talk about government, it's not just the National Department. In fact, the National Department's role in the new Act is very much one of oversight, information management, and so on and so forth. The licensing functions lay largely with the municipalities themselves. And this is for good reason, is that you can imagine the National Department was handing out permits for industries in areas, you know, 1,000 kilometers from where they live. So the municipality being there, they felt close to the action, so they also feel the impact of their decisions. So the first thing in terms of these challenges, the institutional, organizational capacity challenges, the first thing you need is structures in place. Municipalities, provinces, and the National Department actually have to have specific dedicated structures looking at air quality management. And with that, they need to have financing, they need to have appropriate staff in place, and so on and so forth. With that, once they have the structures, they also need to have systems. And systems would be things like, for instance, how to identify problems through air quality monitoring, and so on and so forth. So to find procedures, adequate legislation, regulations in place, and so forth. And specifically for municipalities, one of the systems that is required are proper municipal bylaws. Then once you have the structure and systems, you have to have people there that can actually operate the system. So you have to have skilled individuals. And air quality management is quite... There's a whole bunch of elements. There's an information management element to it. So you don't have to be an air quality expert to manage information. There is a technical component around chemistry and toxicology and so on and so forth. But in essence, I mean, if proper systems are in place, a lot of people can actually be trained to do this quite easily and quickly. And we've already seen that that's exactly what we've taken place. There needs to be incentives across the board for staff to be motivated around this work. And the easiest thing here, of course, is that the biggest incentive for anybody is that if you're doing your work properly, you're actually helping the health of the nation. And that is, as far as a moral incentive for enjoying your work, it must certainly assist, and I can speak here on my own part, is one of my most important incentives. Is that if I'm doing the right thing, then I know that I'm actually having a positive impact on people's health. The other aspect is strategies. You've seen the kind of difficulties of the problems that we have. You know, depending on where you are, the problems change. Therefore, there has to be some strategies on how you deal with these. And of course, the Act itself provides a number of these strategies, things like the licensing regime and so on and so forth, and quite a strict enforcement aspect as well. Air quality management cannot be done on its own. As I've mentioned with the whole housing sort of situation, our relationship with the Department of Minerals and Energy around coal, the Department of Housing around the thermal efficiency of houses, and the Department of Health in terms of indoor air quality, you have to have those relationships in order to solve those problems. You cannot do this alone. In terms of what we're actually doing, on the structural side, the sustainable financing aspect, as you may be aware, once the licensing component comes in, there is a license fee, which means that there is actually a revenue stream from municipalities as the licensing authority. That licensing stream is going to be based, the license fee will be based on the types and sources of emissions. So in other words, if for instance you're a large polluting company, your license fee will be far higher than one that isn't. And of course, that in itself provides economic instruments. First of all, with the license fee of a cost recovery, because government will spend more time on the highly polluting industry than it would on one that's less so. But also, it's an economic instrument in that it kind of gives a signal to the highly polluting companies that if they actually reduce their pollution, then their license fee is reduced. But it's not a very strong one. It's not a tax. It's a wonderful fee, and that's it. But in itself, it's an important revenue stream. The department, from the various publications that we do, give indications of how revenue can be generated. One of the discussions that is happening at the moment, which is specifically critical around the area of electricity at the moment and electricity supply side stuff, is the whole aspect of the electricity tariff and how municipalities themselves can be looking at interesting tariff structures where wasteful use of electricity can be penalized, and that those, that, that penalty can then be used to cost-subsidize free electricity supply and so forth. So the National Department provides a number of platforms around structures to give advice to municipalities. The most important of which is that we have a forum called the Air Quality Officers Forum, and we have an annual air quality governance mechotla, which every single municipal official that is involved in air quality comes to. And this is quite revolutionary in a sense. There are no other structures like this, where we have these structures that meet the province and municipalities together every quarter. And then once a year, we as government, as air quality management officials, get together. Our first launching, the Lechotla, was in 2006, and we had around 50 people. The last one, last year, we had 150 to 200 people for the Lechotla, and it's growing. We've also tried to just put the governance aspect, and we've linked it with a partnership agreement with the National Association of Clean Air, which is an NGO that is probably the represents the biggest professional area of air quality management. And we put them two together to have a governance conference and a technical conference. So government officials are exposed to the Government Act aspect of these things, the administrative procedures and purposes. But the last 2 days they spend in technical meetings, where they have research papers presented to them. And over the last 2 years, government officials have been presenting research papers, which is a new thing, completely. In terms of the systems, and I'll unpack one of them, and I would encourage the members to go to the South African Air Quality Information System, because all the documents that I'm showing you here, they're all there. And once you go and you troll through the South African Air Quality Information System, you can actually start seeing what people are breathing in Orange Farm, for instance, in real time. Mm. And you can generate graphs of what they've been breathing for the last 3 months or the last 2 months or what have you. With that as well, the first of the national network of air quality monitoring stations, of course, went into the first national priority area, being the Bar Triangle. But the next step, the new next 5 air quality monitoring stations are in the process of being sited as we speak in the second national priority area, which is the high cost priority area. In terms of skills development, once again, the Lechotla makes a huge change. We have a situation where all the spheres of government get together, talk about issues of common concern, and there are workshops around specific aspects. Most importantly, though, of course, there'll be atmospheric emission licensing training and manuals and what have you that are in the process of being produced. And we've already gone through a training of all available municipal managers at that particular time around the licensing function. And this will be ongoing until the aspect of the Act, the licensing aspect of the Act, is brought to effect, and the planned time for that is September 11, 2009. So by that stage, the municipalities must be capacitated and ready to start their license construction. In terms of incentives, we do good government case studies. So for areas, for instance, there's one particular municipality that have done exceptionally well. The city that we're in at the moment, the city of Cape Town, is one of those municipalities that has a very good air quality management structure and systems in place. The other one that springs to mind immediately is Etiquini, South Durban Basin, who've done remarkable work in a very short period of time. And we use those good case studies, I think, and I believe that maybe in one of the in the documents you received, you'll actually see a case study around the South Durban Basin, which is the kind of publication that's produced to inspire other municipalities to start putting up the same kind of system and start looking at the lessons learned. We're also in the process, in terms of the publication series for 2009, we'll have things like cost-benefit analyses. The whole idea is that you don't want municipalities to start building capacity, air quality capacity, if they don't have an air quality problem. We have enough issues in South Africa to deal with rather than actually spending money on things that will set on the problem. So one of the things that we will be doing is looking at the cost-benefit analyses in terms of these situations, the appropriate size of structure for the problem. And the national framework makes it very, very clear, is that our current focus is on the 24 municipalities that have already been identified. All the other ones we're not expecting to see them putting a huge amount of effort into air quality management plans because in essence they don't really have a problem. The strategy, one of the most important strategies I believe is the document that you have in front of you, which is the national framework, the 2007 national framework. The 2007 national framework is really the roadmap for the implementation of the Act. It's a very detailed document, and in actual fact, I mean, it's detailed for the very simple reason that this is a new area of interest for people. And so our minister says that, you know, it reads a bit like a textbook, and that's for good reason, because it needs to read like a textbook, because many officials and many of the public that have never had some further on air quality don't know much about the science, and therefore the national framework itself starts unpacking a lot of those issues themselves in a logical and easy to understand way. Interrelationship, this once again is exceptionally important, and the internal interrelationship between the national, the province and the municipalities are exceptionally important, and as I said, we already have these forums and the Lakota that actually deal with this. The link to the National Association of Clean Air, which is the kind of premier scientific body, is also exceptionally important, and government officials, as I said, are becoming so empowered around this area and getting involved in the area that they are now presenting scientific papers to the National Association of Clean Air. I mean, I have the privilege of having staff members who have recently published work in South African Medical Research Journal on the health impacts of air pollution, and those are my staff. And to see that kind of level of expertise that has been growing and it's really been in the last 3 years is really, really encouraging. That's what the coordination and cooperation structure looks like, and you can see on the left-hand side is the government side, which is the national department, provincial department, and local. And the provincial, the Quarterly Provincial Municipal Air Quality Office forums are up and running in provinces where there definitely are problems. Since then, of course, Limpopo province has been set up one, in Mpumalanga province has got the same, and so has North West province. The MINTEC Working Group acts as the Quarterly National Provincial Air Quality Office forum, and then, of course, we have an annual report. On the general public side, the local air quality interest groups are encouraged to deal with their provincial municipal air quality officers forum. The national reference group, we advertise for members of the national reference group, which basically is a group that reports to me and advises me basically on issues of concern, but most importantly, issues of public participation. And at this stage, we ask for nominations from across the nation, looking for representatives from industry, organized labor, NGOs, community-based organizations, and research organizations. And we've received a relatively good number of nominations. However, and very, very surprisingly, very few nominations from the NGOs. And this is a forum specifically set up to talk about participatory process. And this is what the NGOs often say, is that participatory process is not right, so we don't speak to them enough or what have you. And this is a perfect opportunity for them to actually manage that process. And yet we haven't got a single nomination from the most outspoken NGOs, which to me is a bit depressing. Which then begs the question, is the whole aspect of participation really an issue, or is this leverage to get certain points across? Because the real opportunity is now there, and it's not being taken. However, we're not going to stop there. I mean, we're going to basically try to stop asking the NGOs to put forward nominations, because without them being involved in the forum, once again, they can then say it's illegitimate in some sense. So we'll keep on pressing, and we'll only announce the National Reference Group membership once we believe that we've at least got a reasonable representation of the society. In terms of the own department capacity, since 1965, we've basically been running with 10 staff. But as you can see, with the development of the Act in 2001, there's been a slow increase, and from the time the Act was brought into effect, quite a dramatic increase. Our budget has also increased, and it's a steady increase from there, so we've now got the systems, we've got sustainable financing in place, and so on. Our publications, of which I've illustrated some examples as well, this is just a quick listing of them, but it's really important that the department hasn't produced air quality publications in 40 years. We're now producing up to 5 a year, and they're specifically aimed at various spheres as well to give specific interest. The first one in the general information series are basically exactly that, general information series aimed at senior school leavers or senior school learners and first year varsity students. That's the kind of level. So it's very much an introduction to the sources of pollution, how it's managed, and so forth. Then we have the specialist information series, which is basically aimed at the practitioner. And these basically provide information to the air quality managers of municipalities and within consultancies and NGOs themselves. Then there's the ACWA implementation series, which are specifically implementation manuals for government officials. And those would be the licensing manual and so forth. Then the final set of series is the cleaner production series, which provides an insight into what is best practice in certain industries. And of course, the kind of work that we'll be doing there is around not the refinery, for instance, because there are only six of them, but the smaller industries that as you saw in the earlier presentation, are a major cause of concern. So for instance, best practice in dry cleaning stores, best practice in fast food places. One of the ones that is a major issue specifically for rural towns is best practice in brick making. I don't know if any of your constituents have complained about the smoke from brick making, but it's an increasing situation where people have brick making factories that are popping up all over the place, using technology that is effectively 3,000 years old. It's the case where you get clay, pack it up, you pack the entire pile with cobble and you put a match to it and then you walk away for 2 weeks. And as you can imagine, the smoke is not vented, if the wind blows, it blows the smoke in any direction, it's all at the ground level and so forth. So there's a whole bunch of best practice models around that, and that's the kind of publication that's produced there. So the decision makers and communities themselves are empowered to actually start putting pressure on communities. In terms of the key projects and interventions over the last, since the Act came into effect, the air quality officers have been appointed. I am the National Air Quality Officer. All the provincial air quality officers are in place. And certainly all the municipalities that have recognized air pollution problems have air quality officers. So at this stage, for the first time, if you have an issue, there is actually a name that you can speak to. They don't have to be air quality managers, but they have a responsibility to speak to you around air quality issues. As I said, the air quality officer forums are in place. The National Air Quality Governance Report is happening every year, and it's becoming an increasingly high-profile event. And interestingly enough, at the last report, we had a very good turnout from councillors, which we believe is a really, really a positive news. And we encourage that as well. Not just a bunch of bureaucrats sitting around looking at an administrative issue. Councillors are really, really important to be there, to really bring the issues down to the ground. Because typically, administrators start getting caught up in their own little administrative systems rather than, and sometimes forget about what they're actually supposed to be doing. The The National Air Quality Management Reference Group, as I said, that will be hopefully formed as soon as we can persuade the NGOs to be part of that. The National Air Quality Office News, which is a news that's produced by my chief director, which is published also on the South African Air Quality Information System, which is produced every month, which basically gives an update on all the work that we do. All of our projects, what tenders we have running, air quality issues, and so on and so forth. And it's just a small two-pager, which gives a profile of the department and our staff. The ambient air quality standards, an updated set of standards were published for public comment last year. And with the agreement that we'd hold them back until the national framework had been published, which is what's been done. And so we're expecting to see a new set of ambient air quality standards published for public comment in the next 2 to 3 weeks. They've not changed dramatically since the ones that were published initially. Some of them have been tightened up slightly. In terms of priority areas, the Bar Triangle Airshed has been declared, as is the High Fos. The Bar Triangle priority area has already had draft air quality management plan that is ready for publication for public comment. The High Fos, that the development of that process is starting now. The South African Air Quality Information System, which I believe should be regarded as the worthwhile address to take down, because this should be the first point of call for any information that I'm talking about. If you want any further in-depth discussions around any aspect of this work, the South African Air Quality Information System is the place to go. All the legislation is published there, all the gazettes are published there, all the information about our projects are published there, and in fact, if you start going into the Bar Triangle Priority Area Airship stuff from there as well, you'll start seeing photo galleries as well. We've encouraged people to send through photographs of polluting processes, specifically the priority areas. It's not, of course, it's a name and shame situation. What we do is we get the photographs through from whoever wants to give it to us. They give us the time and dates and what they photograph. We then go to the industry consultants and ask them for an explanation, and then we include the industry explanation as well, but we still publish the photographs. So there's a certain amount of fairness involved. Specifically, for instance, with the current issues around the electricity generation, the situation of a power station like Mutaba Power Station has on many occasions over the last couple of months been operating without electricity facilitators, because simply because they cannot afford to turn on the power station to fix these things, which of course is a major cause of concern. But that explanation itself is given on our website with the photograph of the power station. The Air Quality Information System is an exceptionally important partnership. It's the partnership between the National Department and the South African Weather Service. And why that's important is because the South African Weather Service is obviously the absolutely correct and appropriate host for this information. It's an organization that, of course, reports to the department and to yourselves, of course. But it's an organization that deals in information. And therefore, it just seems really, really appropriate that it deal with the information management system. And they will eventually manage the entire national air quality monitoring network as they would do with the national meteorological monitoring network. Other things, the list of activities and associated minimum emission standards. This is the section of the Act that replaces the old licensing regime, where the list of activities require a license in order to operate. And with that, there's a new aspect of the Act that if we identify an industry that requires a license, we also have to identify minimum emission standards for that industry, so that there's a level playing field across the board in terms of what emissions are allowed. And those lists of activities, the initial ones were published in the national framework, they've now been worked up, and the associated minimum emission standards have been drafted and now being submitted to the South African Bureau of Standards process. As I mentioned, the important national framework was published in September last year. The Clean Fires campaign is something that hopefully will be a very high profile campaign in the very, very near future. In fact, we're hoping to have the Clean Fires campaign given a major launch within the Bar Triangle priority area in this winter. It seems a very little time. And since it's basically a joint venture between ourselves, the Department of Minerals and Energy, the Central Energy Fund, around the rollout of the Buzz and Jacob McGaughey approach to fire making. But with a far higher emphasis around the training of new teachers as trainers, because the way it's been done in the past is that it's mostly consultants who are doing the training, and that's not sustainable in any way. The review of the registration certificates, this is an exceptionally important project as well, which is a kind of transition between the old act and the new. What in effect is happening is that the departments with provinces and affected municipalities are now reviewing the current licenses of 70 industries that are responsible for 80% of emissions in the country. And you can see what they are. They are the 7 petrochemicals, the 9 primary steel manufacturers, the 2 aluminium smelters, the ferroalloy industry, the pulp and paper industries, and of course all of our coal-fired power stations. So at the moment, we're in the process of finalizing those reviews, and the registration certificates will be tightened up from a literacy point of view, because many of the current licenses from 1965 are just unenforceable. So even if you pollute a huge amount, your license allows you to do so. So that's exactly what we're doing, tightening up enough so that it can be enforceable in terms of their emissions. With that, of course, that process is leading to the Atmospheric Emission Licensing Manual, which has template standard forms and guidelines, which of course all the municipalities that will be licensed in Rogers will be trained in the use of. The license fee calculator I've talked about, this is its revenue stream. And the National Air Quality and Management Planning Manual provides the manual on how to produce the plans that are required by that. And that, Chair, is where I'm going to stop. The rest of the presentation is just to unpack one of those projects just to give you some level of detail, but I'll only do so if there's any interest in that particular thing, if that's okay.
Thanks, for your thought-provoking presentation. It definitely gives us something to think about. Some of us who do come from the disadvantaged communities and still live in those communities are definitely affected by some of the air pollution that you spoke about, particularly the mining industry around Deep Blue, Bridgeport, Mainland, all those areas. Something that, before I could open up for discussion, something that you mentioned that caught my attention was the development of new townships. And what we see happening most of the time is houses rolling throughout the whole area. And nobody ever thinks in terms of planting trees along that development. So the question to you would be, have you thought of having a joint discussion with the Department of Housing, the Department of Forestry and Water Affairs, and the various local authorities to think of a strategy that when they design some of the new townships coming up, it would have to be done in a joint effort in order to combat the very problem that we are having in air pollution? That's my question. So I will take questions from the members on the floor. I see Machamos. I see Maze Manyembe. I see Dr. Kachalia. In that order. And that is where. In that order. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. That was a huge amount of, I think he was trying to smother us before we started thinking about questions, because there was just so much information, which was very, very interesting. Just a few things I would like to ask, one of them being that coming from the Port Elizabeth area, of course, Kucha and the aluminium smelter that is looks as though it's going to happen there. When the EIA is done, how much is the future impact of pollution taken into account, and is it possible to be able to really work out what that pollution will be and act accordingly before, and or is it part of an EIA process? That's my one question. The other one, another one is that with your the retention of officials within your department, are you able to compete the father sticks there in order to defend them, because time and time again one hears of officials becoming competent, gaining the skills, and then being wooed and taken away into the private sector, and then you start all over again. And the only way really to combat that is with appropriate salaries and benefits within the government, which government keeps saying they can't afford. So how is that likely to impact on beach? The other industry that you haven't mentioned, and increasingly one hears that it's becoming quite a major problem, is the cement industry. And yet another, of course, is the whole is waste management, as far as something like medical waste is concerned, and incineration. I mean, it's a problem in every country in the world. I was in Australia last year, and they themselves, and they're a highly technically adept country at managing waste and pollution, but they still haven't found an answer for medical waste. So I have some other questions, but I'll hand over to the other members for the panel.
Thank you very much for this wonderful presentation. But you know, it worries me so much, because we listen to this presentation, and at a certain stage you don't know how factual are they, things that are going to be done. There are so many, you know, things. But now when you get to the communities, you find a different story, which we will never forget. It seems the Vile Triangle, KZN and Mpumalanga, are the worst provinces affected. You mentioned Zambela. I don't want to see those people. The day I met them, the way they were furious. And I hope something has been done. We visited one of the factories in South Obey. It was a plastic factory. And they were telling us the same story, that there isn't much that affects the Zambela people. But when we met the people, it was a different story. It's just a pity, because it seems of now late, the committee hasn't had time to visit those areas as an oversight. KZN, those refineries, I don't know whether what I'm hearing today is really going to help those communities, because they are suffering. Well, in as much as we would like those companies or whatever to remain for empowering employment purposes, but one feels something has to be done. You spoke of old technology which is applied by certain people, which does not help in the spread of pollution. I don't know. I just feel like, you know, there was a method which was used by this committee sometime back. You meet the communities, you meet the management, then you compare, you get stories. Yeah. But now, I, for one. I just feel that maybe the department just, you know, sings song. They tell and tell and tell and you listen, and it's so nice, you know, you so have hope that something is happening. But well, my request is just that people, I hope what has been just said related to us this morning is going to help those people. I thank you.
I think I recognize Dr. Kacharya. I didn't see your hand. I'll take your hand on the neck now.
Thank you very much for your submission. A couple of questions here. Your comment on this the back agreement being evaluated and measured. The second question relates to global warming. Alaska produces only 2% of the world's emission of gases. The aim of the integrated plan, I think, is to introduce non-fossil fuel forms of energy generation. What are we doing to streamline the requirements of international conventions? Third short question is, what progress has been made on the 4-Mercury cleanup program? The final question relates to some further elucidation on the progress that has been made with regard to the training of environmental and management inspectors. Thank you very much.
Knowledge management in government, and in the context of operation in terms, we put this thing up on it, as I said, when we make reference to the South African crisis, you see, that issue that can be used, what is the correlation between the work that we are doing and the condition of equality, and so on. Because the sword does appear to be just a symbolic organization in the government with a particular character, and yet all that should be integrated in the context of equality. So what is the connection? What is the connection? And it's more a question that the commission is saying, but it's a question of governance. But part of the inability to deliver is caused by the systems of creation of silos, that silo, and all of them have very excellent knowledge. Now, this knowledge, how it is managed in this kind of process, is the way it is getting public and filtered out of the community to the problem. You look at silos throughout, and silos by definition are parallel, then it's difficult to have convergence on the ground. But that's where from the zero and the so, it's what I was, and that leads me to another one point. I'm glad that you formed this equality forum. Now, when you do meet, I know I'm aware you formed just about 2 years ago, when you do meet, do you use that forum to at least break the silos, create convention? Or is that forum only created for the sake of linking up with civil society? You say NGOs and come. I don't think we should be parallel for the fact that NGOs don't come, but I'm happy that they're actually making it. Because NGOs always try to complain that they're being marginalized. Now, here's a classic example where government has actually set up a forum where they should come. But then they took away because they want to become unique as the only forum that comes and collects issues. And sometimes it's very eloquent. And I'm actually surprised that NGOs haven't espoused, you know, this is for me. And I'm actually impressed that for the first time, one of the few cases where government actually starts a forum and say, public, come and participate. And people don't come forward. Normally it's the other way around, where civil society mobilizes itself and they say, go to government, this is who we are. Once you participate in government, plans in the opposite direction. So it's a very interesting situation. Finally, last week I preached a session from the speaker, and we had a conversation on Western Europe. And the issue of Kalindaba came up. And the Honorable Gareth Morgan raised the issue of we had a public hearing, that's the context of future public hearing, and nuclear pollution, etc. A lot of people came from HIV and complained about how they suffered because of the way NASA handled them. And then the question then was how to compensate those people in respect of health and social support, etc. And now, the instrument that was sort of using was the evidence. I think Morgan used the physiological evidence. Now, you, in the department, can actually assist what you should have in the beginning of the study, because you say you got instruments in a certain area. Theoretically, it was a simple study, how much pollution there. Now, this is now using the application. Now, do you have some evidence that can assist to take what the process of that relief of those people that have been spending down?
You may respond and then we'll take another round of questions.
Thank you very, very much. I will try to go through all of them. So your first question on the aspect of the holistic housing development, which is really what it boils down to. Is this such an important question? And it comes down to the sort of situation where we really start having to ask the question of quantity versus quality. But in many instances, there are quantity aspects that actually have no cost that can make a huge difference to people's lives, and just two problems that. The first one that springs to mind is just the orientation of housing. The usual situation is that we have houses that people need all over the place, depending so that they can face the road, for instance. Whereas, in essence, that's not the correct way of building a house. I mean, in the South African situation, houses must be north facing. They must have been a situation where they have a slight overhang to be cool in summer and warm in winter, because they have direct sunlight. That is a no-cost intervention. Just the movement of houses on the sand is to point in the right direction, but have a huge dramatic impact on the energy use of that particular house. Does the Department of Environment do anything like that? Of course it does. It's the Department of Housing and the municipalities and the developers. So there's a huge requirement for us to start getting exactly this issue of silos. It's for us to actually deal with it together. Not as separate entities, but as basically a task team that works together around sustainable housing development. Because the same situation is involved. I mean, internationally, it's proved that in these kind of situations, by passing a deciduous tree next to a house, one that actually provides shade to the house during summer, but in winter loses its leaves and then therefore allows sunlight to penetrate and warm the house, is one of the easiest ways of actually looking at energy efficiency in low-income homes. Well, not low-income homes, anybody's home, in fact. And these are kind of no-cost interventions which, first of all, actually improve the quality of people's lives. Because, as you say, I mean, and in fact, I think it was the president himself who commented about why does Soweto look like this and Parktown look like this. Parktown looks like a forest and Soweto looks like a desert. The whole aspect of tree planting is in our past. We can plant trees. In fact, Johannesburg is the largest human-made forest in the world. And it wasn't because somebody came and did it, we did. So there's a huge opportunity for us to actually start doing the kind of work that we're actually starting looking to, sustainable settlements that are low energy users, that are comfortable, and the places that are really nice to be in. And that requires, exactly as you say, and the whole aspect of the silos. It requires the Department of Environment to work with the Department of Housing, the Department of Health, and specifically the local municipalities around these developments. And that, I'm afraid, is not happening very, very well. So hopefully, this intervention that we're looking at, which is an air pollution intervention, will start creating those links. Because the reality we've now got a mandate from all these effects of the past which are saying, well, the reason we haven't been dealing with air quality and low income settlements, and dense low income settlements, is because we weren't quite sure who was responsible. Is it the Department of Health? Yes, they are responsible for indoor air quality. Is it the Department of Minerals and Energy? Yes, they are responsible for coal, and that's very true. Is it the Department of Housing? Yes, of course they're responsible for the types of houses and how they're built. Is it the Department of Environment? Yes, of course we're responsible for air that's outside those buildings. It's now been agreed from these departments that the Department of Environment will actually run the process of developing the strategy. And so for the first time there's a champion. And the strategy development workshop will be happening in the next 2 or 3 months. And I'd really love the opportunity of giving this portfolio committee a presentation on the findings of that strategy as it evolves, because I can learn so much from yourselves and what comes to your own constituency. So it's an exciting development and hopefully one of the most important developments in terms of actually bringing various departments together cohesively in the way they should be doing. So hopefully I've touched on that. On the aspects of EIAs, every single EIA that's done by the national department, and of course those are the biggies, including the power stations and what have you, a technical task team is formed to do the assessment of the EIA. So in other words, all the air quality components are assessed by my chief director. So typically, for instance, with the Madupi power station in the north, we did all the work around looking at the pollution from there and the modelling of how it was going to impact and so on and so forth. And our decision, the record of the decision makes it quite clear that, for instance, our concerned aspect of sulfur dioxide from the coal. We were given to understand through the modelling and what have you that there was unlikely to be a problem. However, it was on the cusp. So the record of the decision says that if any problem arises based on ambient air quality monitoring, we demanded that Eskom actually puts up a proper monitoring station specifically in the residential area downwind. If a problem arises, then Eskom has to make the right decision to actually reduce the sulfur. However, and this is a difficulty, is that looking at what is going to happen in the future, and I think this is what you're alluding to, is that we can make a decision on something now, and then suddenly something happens in the future that starts making an impact on this. So it's almost like, for instance, if you get your foot in the door first, you can pollute more than anybody else, because everybody else is looking at your situation. I'll use the Madupi power station as an example. In the Madupi power station, the new power station there is going to increase air pollution in that area. It's unlikely to...
In
the Waterberg.
Sorry?
In the Waterberg. Lepalai. In the Waterberg. Now that particular power station, which will be right next door to the existing Matimba power station, if on its own and it operates on its own, it's unlikely to cause a major air pollution problem. However, if we start getting any other substantial developments in that area, then we could be starting to look at a completely new air pollution hotspot in this country that was never perceived before. For the first time in our lives, we're suddenly in a situation where the air pollution may be exacerbated by our neighbours. As many of you may know, the Madupi power station and the Matimba power station is built on the Waterberg coal reserve. The Waterberg coal reserve extends all the way into two blocks in Botswana. And Botswana is planning to build a power station across the border. Which means that with the prevailing wind conditions, for the first time in our history, where South Africa has been the biggest exporter of pollution, suddenly we're going to be the victims of pollution. And suddenly our power station and the air quality in that area may be affected from pollution from our neighbouring state, from Botswana. And that starts creating a problem. It's quite possible that the Botswana developments may actually reduce the air quality in that area that doesn't meet national standards. Furthermore, there's also talk of setting up a new coal-to-liquid plant in that area as well. That in itself has dramatic implications, specifically from a sulfur point of view. So there is a difficulty in that you cannot predict the future. You can only make decisions on the information that you have to hand. And it would be unfair for us to say, yes, we can't build here because we believe that Botswana may build a power station in the future. So it's an exceptionally difficult situation. And that's why the ambient air quality approach is the only way to do this, is that you're not licensing on the emissions from the factory, you're licensing around what people are breathing. So if there are any new developments in that Lepalali area, they would have to have majorly reduced air pollution in order to actually establish there in the first place. This then starts coming to the area, which I am not favorable of, but it certainly comes to an area that brings a lot of interest from a lot of people, is the whole aspect of emissions trading. Because if, for instance, Sasol wants to create a new plant up in that Lepalali area, it would mean that we would say that their sulfur reduction would have to be dramatic. And they would then go to Eskom and say, hang on, it would be cheaper for you to reduce your sulfur than it would be for us. And therefore, let's make a deal. You spend the money on the pollution control that we won't spend, and we'll work out some sort of deal. And that's also fine, as long as the ambient air quality is maintained. So that's the kind of thing that will have to happen in the future. On the
perhaps before you go further, you mentioned something that had to do with Botswana and the area. Now, in view of the fact that Botswana is part of the SADC community, have you thought of having a SADC forum that would deal with air quality control within the SADC community?
There is a particular organization called APIMA, which is an air pollution forum for the SADC region. At this stage, it's mostly an academic forum, so it's mostly the air quality academics from the area that speak together. Government itself has not been, we've not been speaking to the Botswana government at all. And the reason for that is that that particular project has not really been, there's talk about it. Politically, it's actually quite difficult for us, because it would be, from a foreign affairs point of view, is that for us to go speak to Botswana and say we'd like to speak to you about the new power station and emissions, when for years we've been the exporter of pollution, and we've never given Swaziland a chance to actually come and say that we're destroying their forests with acid rain from our power station.
We've been the United States.
Yeah, we've been the United States of Africa at this particular point in terms of our export of pollution. So it actually becomes quite a difficult situation. However, from what I understand about the new power station, which is probably going to be World Bank funded, the new Botswana power station is probably going to have a stricter emissions regime than our own power station, which would be a bit embarrassing as well for us to go across to say, well, we want to be stricter than what we do ourselves. But it's a fair point, and I think one of the things that we need to do is that if there is some confirmation that this is going to happen, to form some kind of a monitoring committee with the Botswana government in terms of air pollution, I think is an excellent idea. The thing is, we're already the victims of exported pollution, I must tell you. And one of the photographs that I normally show, because it's really quite impressive, is that there's almost a wave of pollution that goes through from Central Africa and comes up and right across us and exits between Swaziland and Lesotho. And it's like a stream of pollution, and it's from dust and from forest burning and so on and so forth. My staff, Tabi Roseni, who's my researcher, did a piece of research around the president of Lekgotla the president had a Lekgotla in Gauteng, and it was basically disrupted by a huge dust cloud. And he wanted to know where this dust was coming from. And my researcher, as part of her master's thesis, that was the basis of her thesis, to find out where the dust was from. And the interesting fact was that the dust that we were measuring in Johannesburg was actually from the Makgadikgadi pan in Botswana. So in terms of dust and particulate matter, we've actually asked all the victims in many instances, where we've laid our own mind up for a national fact, we're getting salt dust from Botswana as well. So your point is well taken. I think as we start building up our expertise, and we certainly are, the time for us to start dealing with our neighbours is very, very soon and close to hand. The aspect of staff retention is exceptionally important. And at this stage, the department is probably seen as the employer of choice for anybody who is now entering into the air quality field. because they believe at this stage that this is where the action is happening. But that's going to change quite dramatically. I mean, once these societies start building themselves up, what have you, we know that they're going to leave stuff. I have had the, I guess it's a privilege, I believe, of actually getting some of the most amazing people into my C-Story interest. And I'll give you some of the examples. For instance, my deputy director for regulations, a person who develops our regulations, is the only recognized black environmental lawyer in the country, Sudhakar Chavalala. And his master's thesis was on regulatory control for climate change. So he's a top expert in the country on in terms of evolution regulation. And he's my staff member. The reality, of course, is that Sudhakar Chavalala is probably going to reign on me for 18 months. Because he is learning so much, he's getting so much, he's so involved in the work that we're doing, that this guy has a shining career ahead of him. And I, of course, would love him to stay with me forever, but the chances of him actually doing that are very, very small. So with that, Sibusisu has an understudy. Young lawyer, who basically works as an understudy, who's being groomed for the position once he receives to go. We're not, of course, trying to get him to go at all. We want him to stay as long as possible. But when he does, or if he does, there will be somebody that can actually step into that post as well. We've also looked at the aspect, as I mentioned earlier, is that a lot of the work that we do is not specialist work. So, for instance, our information management side are IT people. And IT people, there are lots of them around. So people come to work for us to get IT expertise in the area of air quality, and therefore there's not really other places to go unless they join the South African Weather Service, which of course we'd be happy to have. The other thing is that losing air quality managers to municipalities, for instance, which is often the case, for our, at this stage, it's first time. That's exactly it. I mean, for the department is used as a training ground to start building the capacities of our local authorities, then we accept that completely. Of course, it's sad to see our good people going, but they're going to places that really make a difference. So that's important for us. But with all that said and done, we've managed to retain our staff relatively well. They're enthusiastic, and I reckon the reason for it is because we're doing so much. There's so much happening in a very short period of time. And even junior officials are heavily involved in that, so there's a level of excitement. The incentive, of course, is because it's just really nice work and what have you. But there is no doubt that as air quality issues become more and more mainstream, and specifically with increasing interest around climate change, my staff are going to be in high demand. So the intention is to try and create the post as generic as possible so that I don't need to have these specialists working there. I can buy in the speciality and remain as a training ground for people. So that's our strategy. You mentioned the cement industry, and the cement industry is not on the list of the top 50 polluters. That list was drawn based on a matrix of emissions. So there's a very scientific basis for it. And they just fell off the list. If we extend that list, they'll be the first one on the new list. And that's exactly what's going to happen, is that once we've gone through this bunch, which is using the 80-20 principle, this is 20% of the industries that are responsible for 80% of the emissions. Once we've done them, we'll then move into the second row. And cement will certainly be on the top of that new list. So they haven't been lost.
Just on that issue, it may be because there's not a lot of it going on,
but
where it is happening,
it's acutely polluting. Potentially true. I mean, some of the cement kilns actually operate very, very well. Certainly in terms of particulate matter as well. I mean, there's no visible smoke coming from stacks and what have you. The one that springs to mind, which is the Jupiter plant, which is operated by PPC outside Johannesburg, is a plant that is often blamed for air pollution, yet its air pollution control is excellent. What is actually happening is that it has two factories next door to it. One is an acid recycling plant, which produces all sorts of complete nasty things, which of course at this stage is not a listed activity, so it's not even licensed. And it's really their emissions that are the cause of complaint, but because the smokestack of the cement kiln is much higher, people blame the cement kiln. So So that's an area that we need to look at as well. Luckily, I mean, many of these cement hills as well, apart from places like Jupiter and the PPC in Pretoria, most of the cement hills are out in quite undeveloped areas. And most of them have pretty high stacks too. So, but there are, but we've acknowledged there are problems that we need to address. The aspect of incineration and medical waste specifically, I mean, incineration, we already have, and we have had, over 150 licensed incinerators operating in the country. And many instances, one would say thank God, because a lot of these are actually providing electricity. If one considers the incinerators operated by Sasol, that provide a huge amount of Sasol steam and their own electricity requirements and what have you, these incinerators are not incinerators, they're power generators, or boilers. When it comes down to incinerators, they're just waste, purely waste incinerators that are not co-generation, they're not producing a product, they're just being used to destroy waste. Well, personally, I mean, and I can only speak personally, I mean, I'm relatively opposed to that sort of situation. There has to be some kind of a benefit from this as well. But as you're aware, and probably from the presentation of the waste form, there's a policy development process that is underway around incineration, specifically to deal with these sort of situations, because we know internationally that inappropriate waste burnt in inappropriate technology leads to disaster. It's a mess. Dioxins and furans and what have you. However, appropriate waste burnt in appropriate technology is probably the best way of dealing with particular types of waste. And if one talks about medical waste, tissue waste, which is the nasty bits and pieces, the amputated arms and the legs and the what have you, the only way of dealing with this properly is through incineration. There is no other choice. There's been talk about grinding it up and putting it to steam and then putting it to landfill. And of course, I mean, that is, first of all, undignified and unacceptable. In terms of the Tissue Act says that anatomical waste must be burned. And for good reason, because it is the most effective way of dealing with anatomical waste. But with that said, even if we're burning amputated limbs and what have you, which is the right thing to do, to add PVC plastic to that mix causes a huge problem. So there are types of waste streams that you just don't want to burn. And mostly those are the ones that contain chlorine, because they become problem and they produce products of incomplete combustion that can be often be more poisonous than the poisons that we can incineration, etc. So we have to be very, very careful around that. And with that, we're working very, very much once again breaking silos, working with our waste management section on and their policy development process. We're taking international best practice. And in terms of the emission standards that we've put forward, these are based on the best emission standards in the world. And we expect that the incinerator industry, if the policy says that it should go ahead, that's exactly how it will perform. The aspect of that you brought up about measurable impact, you're absolutely right. I mean, me sitting here giving you a whole bunch of hot air is absolutely meaningless as far as the air that people breathe. The nice thing is that we now have a situation where you have the basis of a whisk to beating with continuously, and that's real measurement. With the ambient air quality monitoring network, you can actually physically go in and see what the air pollution looks like, and then do a comparison to what it looked like a year ago. And if it's not improved, then I'm the person coming back, bash her up, because that's my job. If it has improved, then of course you compliment it. But the reality is that before that, we've never had that situation. So, and it's always been tough. Unless you actually have that the information to make an informed decision, it is a case of stories. And communities will tell you this story, and management of industries will tell you this story, and the municipality will tell you this story. But they're all stories. Unless somebody brings up a graph and says, this is the level of dust people are breathing, this is what they're breathing now, this is what they breathed last year, and this is what they're breathing the year before. That's the only basis of it. And typically, for instance, in terms of the South Durban situation, in the South Durban Basin, the measurements of the reduction in sulfur are there. They're real. There's a 40% reduction in sulfur. That's it. It's there. It's measured. It's documented. Everybody knows it. And you yourself have probably been in a situation where the amount of complaints that have come from South Durban has dramatically fallen. There's always full complaints. And there often will be. And the issue is certainly not resolved. There are still huge problems there. And new problems, too. Emerging problems. The whole situation of volatile organic compounds, which are possibly cancer-forming and stuff like that, these are emerging issues. And this is the challenge. I mean, once we've solved the salsa issue, then the next one comes onto the list. And that's the way we have to work through it. But the reality is that, and you'll see it from as well, as of this year, I am supposed to produce, in terms of the national framework, I have to produce the National Air Quality Office's report, which is basically a factual-based, measurable report on air quality in South Africa, which I will present to you, which says, that's what air was yesterday, that's what it was today, that's what it was a year ago, here's how we perform it. So it gives you the real stick and not the story. So hopefully that, and that to me is the most important, the measurable impact of what we do, not just the words. The aspect around old technology, I mean, the old technology aspect, I mean, should be at the top of our minds right now. I mean, with the whole electricity situation as it stands, and with the decisions that came out of Cabinet and Kotler as well, is that the lowest hanging fruit for starting to look at demand side management for electricity is in energy efficiency. Industrial energy efficiency is the lowest hanging fruit. We have plants around this country that have electrical motors that operate 24 hours a day. Those electrical motors are 40 years old. They're the oldest type of technology. They use twice as much electricity as they're supposed to use. It makes financial sense for the company to replace them. And you ask the question, well, why don't they? If it's a good investment and they actually have money savings, why don't they do it? It almost comes down to a situation of human nature. And the closest thing that I could think about in terms of how to describe it is, I have a remote control for my TV, which has been dropped. And it's been fixed with a piece of tape. And I have to hold it in a certain way and press the button in a certain way in order to make the thing work. I know that I could just go out to the shop and buy a new remote control and everything would be fine. But I sit there and I fiddle with it because I don't want to throw this old thing away. Right? It's got some sort of sentimentality. And that's almost what it's like. It really is an easy financial decision to say, let's replace our energy inefficient pumps because it will actually save us money. But to actually take stuff that's working and throw it away is something that people find difficult to do, I think, and the industries themselves. So there has to be something around the old technologies. We need to start. These things have to be phased out. And with the new emission standards that we're setting, there are transitions. So the new emission standards for industry sort of say, if you build this industry now, this is your emission standard. If you built this industry in 60 years ago, this is your emission standard, but you must start meeting this one in 10 years' time. So that means that there's a strong regulatory approach for industries to start updating this technology over time. And that's a very, very important point. There was a question around the plastic bag agreement. I made no mention of that. And it's a waste issue that doesn't really fall in my jurisdiction, but if there's any information you require that, I'd be happy to get the information for you. The aspect of climate change and the streamlining of this, I mean, as you're aware, South Africa is punches above its weight when it comes to international negotiations around climate change. And we've done exceptionally well in those negotiations from a South African standpoint. With that, and that is a presentation on its own, what is happening around climate change is a really important thing, and one of the things that the Portfolio Committee should engage with is the outcome of the long-term mitigation scenario building process, which is actually interesting. It is basically a cabinet-approved process where the department has led research around how do we reduce our carbon. And now with the current electricity crisis, the findings are very, very interesting because they're actually matching our entire electricity crisis, because the first thing is the energy efficiency industry. So what we've done is we've mapped scenarios of carbon emissions for South Africa to the long term, to 2050. And with a growth without constraint scenario, we are going to increase our greenhouse gas emissions four times, which of course is completely unacceptable. We then map the required by science what we need to do from a scientific point of view to maintain temperature at about 2 degrees C. And then we look at a whole bunch of interventions that are required to bring us after. And that's what this long-term mitigation scenario process has done, has basically mapped these kind of interventions. And that in itself would be a very, very interesting presentation to this committee, I think. Because it really starts looking at the big picture about our development path from an energy perspective. And you'll immediately start seeing the parallels of the discussions around solutions to the electricity crisis as well around the energy, the demand side management aspect of things. So with that, in terms of the streamlining aspect, I mean, the climate change stuff now with the long-term mitigation scenarios for the power plant is going is doing ongoing discussions around this, and eventually will involve, end up in a cabinet memo around recommendations about what we need to do. And hopefully from there, we'll start the climate change policy development process, which will then involve all the affected departments. So typically, for instance, we would probably facilitate that process from a national department point of view. But the aspects of climate change response to water and forestry, of course, is RAS, Wendell's in energy, agriculture, the adaptation stuff, the impact of oceans will be marine and coastal zones, and so on and so forth. But we would probably facilitate that policy development process, which I'd imagine would start but sometime mid this year. You asked the question on the four chemicals issue, mercury. Once again, that's a waste issue, which is not in my jurisdiction, so I can certainly find out the current status for you. I'm afraid I can't get that to you right now. And then, once again, the EMIs are also in the same sort of situation, and I found as if I'm really falling into silos here. I have been involved in these things. I mean, as you probably know, I mean, I was the founder of the EMIs, and I've since moved on from that. Although I miss it a lot, I'm going to tell you. but in terms of an update on the green scorpions and the EMIs and what have you, that is from our regulatory service months ago. If you require that, we can certainly facilitate that happening. The point around knowledge management and South African Weather Services, I mean, I can't applaud you more for what you've said. I mean, this whole sort of situation of silos is a disease. Where we sit in our sort of situations and we are almost navel-gazing in terms of our own areas and exceptionally concerned about potential turf battles and arm wrestling about who does what and what have you. The reality is that that's not the way things can work. And it's certainly not the way that you have progress. And it certainly is the way that, for instance, we've actually had no progress. Typically, for instance, residential air pollution and dense low-income settlements is a typical case in point. No one has taken responsibility. Everybody has a role. But no one takes responsibility to actually put it all together. So as a result of that, you have DME with a small intervention here, and health with a small intervention here, and environment with there's no coordinated effort at all. And so hopefully that's the work that we'll be doing around strategy that will involve all those departments intimately will actually overcome that situation. But you're right. In terms of our forums, they have overcome that dramatically. It's a fantastic situation where I now have an opportunity to physically speak to my municipal counterparts. Because in essence, they're the ones with the problem. You know, sitting in my office in Pretoria, I'm not seeing what people are breathing in Port Elizabeth, for instance. But when I speak to my counterparts in Port Elizabeth, there's suddenly some real on-the-ground stuff about what is really their major problems and what they have. But even the issues that are not seen as major problems, typically in the Western Cape Forum, and I question the various municipalities about their deepest concerns around air quality. The delegates from NYSMA sort of said, it's that train. And I said, what train? No, it's a train, it's an old puffing billy train and what have you, which of course is a huge tourist attraction. And I said, that's our biggest source of air pollution. So I said, well, you're not going to stop that. I mean, it's also your biggest source of revenue, surely. Surely the community, the train operators and yourselves can get together and ask them to actually use cleaner coal when they enter into town and what have you. Because one of the appeals, the tourist appeals of the train is the smoke. And it's hardly causing any real damage to anybody. But that's the kind of, at least, we've stepped out of the silos and we're starting to deal with people's real concerns on the ground that people are having. But it's far from done. I mean, as you've seen from my presentation as well, in terms of the air quality issues, the issue of, for instance, who controls dust from mining? Is Minerals and Energy. And yet, as you can see, they're breathing in as much as the stuff they control. And it comes down to your second question, radioactive air pollution. We don't have any jurisdiction over that system. And this is straight down to silos once again, is that if we start making an intervention there, then of course, you know, we are stepping on the toes of some other departments that become defensive and so on and so forth. However, with the nuclear regulator, we're in the process of IM7 finalized a memorandum of understanding with them around EIA. And in that, there's an element around the air quality aspect as well. They will actually report to us in terms of the stuff that they measure. But with that said, you brought up a very interesting point, and it relates to the point around the EIA too. Is one of the things the National Department is going to be doing is to develop a uniform air quality model where you feed in the information of the emissions from any particular source, which we are trying to gather as we speak, and it's being housed with South African weather service, of course, all the meteorological information has been fed in, and then you can predict what happens in the future. You can predict what air pollution is going to be like, and then you can start putting in new sources of based on new developments and predict what it's going to look like for the future. And with that kind of tool, we are suddenly going to be hugely empowered in terms of what is happening, where these things are going. And also with that tool as well, we'll be able to see areas where there is a potential air pollution problem from the community's point of view. And in terms of epidemiological research, that's exactly where you would aim. If, for instance, from your model, you say, hang on a second, these people who live in this particular area here are being fumigated with a lot of sulfur. That's our prediction. Then you can start doing epidemiological research to see if actually they are, whether they are and whether it's having an impact on their health. So one of the big challenges for us is to link our air quality monitoring to the environmental health, which helps the system. And we're doing that through the Department of Health, but we're also trying to facilitate that through the HSRC. We've been doing a lot of work around the impacts of air pollution.
We'll take the next and last round of questions. Back to you, sir.
What worries me here is, first of all, the municipal dumping site, the rural towns, where they are supposed to issue the license, and then they come around and they light up the dumping sites. And I had a lot of arguments a couple of weeks ago with the municipal manager down in Brindau. He wanted to tell me about his rights and this law and this law. But the point is, their dumping site is next to the township. Then it's something else that worries me. When I drive on the N7, and you've got all the cornfields, what they do with this poisonous fertilizer and things, they fly with an airplane, little aircraft, over those cornfields, and then they release the poison in the air. In agriculture. I mean, there was a story in Malmesbury, where they go with a tractor into the vineyards, spray all this poison in the air. And if you talk to them, you get a very funny answer. I mean, isn't something in the law which can bring us to stop them or something, or I don't know. That's all I want to know. Thank you.
Machama?
Thank you, Chair. Just sort of a general question. In your department, you have a huge amount of excess that has been built up over really quite a period of time. Do you, with the big and small business who are finding themselves in a situation where they are producing and it's costing them money and they need to do something about it. And there are consultants around who are making a lot of money out of being consultants, and I'm sure they have varying degrees of expertise. Are you able, in the interest of air quality, to advise companies that are maybe starting new ventures, etc., or do you just not have the capacity and the time and to be able to fulfill a role in an advisory capacity? And then another question I have is around, I was reading an article on Eskom, and one of the problems is that there could be huge amounts of ash. That there was something like 33 million tons of ash per annum, which they dump down this water, which, and again, it's a waste problem, not initially a pollution problem, but some of it must go into the air. And for communities living in and around the depth, wherever it is, that area, which would be a coal burning area, how can that be controlled? Are there technologies that your department finds out about that where you can advise and say, look, there is a new technology, try, can you play a role in reducing pollution as opposed to just monitoring and finding out how much pollution there is? Can you be proactive as well as reactive?
I'll put just one last big one. Okay, Malvara, I'll ask the question after you.
Thank you very much. The presenter spoke about the tree planting. And it is true that as we grow up, we are waiting to see trees in the white area. And nothing is ours was just there. But now, there is a difference because of our country. You've got councillors, and every year in September, they make sure that we get trees, because we work with them in the constituency. They are part of the constituency. They make sure that trees come in, and a small, and even you all call someone that brings in trees. And school children will go out and plant trees in their schools. Not many, but there and then. And residents will come in and take trees and plant them. Now, these days, it is no longer like what it used to be in the times of apartheid, where our streets were just there without any, our townships were not even planned, and there was no way that we could find storm drainage in the township. Now, our councillors are doing a very good job as far as planting trees are concerned, and the roads, and managing the roads and the structures of planning for the township. But what I'd like to ask you is, now that there were a few coal burning stations that were generating electricity, I can speak of one, and I'll always mention it because it has given me and my family and all the people who are next to me a lot of problems. That what if Orlando Power Station is made into use again? Coal is going to be burned there again. During that time, the coal was burned there, but the electricity was not coming to Soweto. It was going to white areas. In Soweto, we were burning candles. We did not have electricity. We were burning coal in stones. And that congestion of coal burning and that power station made it very impossible to walk around, especially early in the morning and in the evening. Now, how is it going to be controlled? Would that pollution be controlled now? Because those power stations are still there, they are still standing there. They can be used. But if they are used, in the past they were not supplying us. In case they are used, how is it that pollution going to be controlled?
Chairperson, it's just a comment. In fact, it's not a question. As I was listening to the presenter, he made mention of greening. Then I immediately thought of greening of the nation. Well, they go about, they green the schools, which means those children are really protected, because it has something to do with air pollution, you know. Them playing around the school grounds, there's a lot of dust coming up, you know, and some, what you name it. There's a school next to Mondi in the Devon South, you know, it's so near that place, Mondi, which has a very strong, you know, what. I so wish they could plant a lot of trees around there. I so wish. Because now I've heard, because I always worry. That Mondi, what do you call it? Is it a what?
Paper.
A paper what?
Paper.
Yes. You know, as you know. But green is very... Thank you, Manza. Trees by school children.
Thank you. Very last question. I just wanted to find out, you can answer this one if you wish to. What legal recourse have communities got to hold government and the various companies accountable? Is it any way possible that they could cite the constitution and have a class action lawsuit against those people to make sure that at least they comply with some of the rules and regulations as far as the equity control is concerned?
Thank you very much. On the aspect of municipal dumping sites, first of all, landfill sites themselves are not listed activities in terms of the atmospheric, either the Atmospheric Pollution Prevention Act or the Air Quality Act. For the simple reasons, they're not supposed to be there. For the other thing. And that, of course, is a huge problem, is that the municipalities will not be the licensing authority for those landfills. The province will be. So if, for instance, the municipality burns its landfill, then, of course, they're basically committing an offence. Which, of course, is difficult because, you know, the Constitution says that government should avoid taking government to court. The enforcement around that aspect is always difficult. And so, therefore, I mean, there's a level of stick and carrot, I think, around the proper management of waste. Because what really happens is that many of these sites are actually illegal sites that are operated by municipalities. They're badly designed, and they're getting full. And the easiest way of reducing the volume of the waste is to start putting a match to it. And it's just completely unacceptable because you don't even know what's in those sites. So the kind of smoke that you're breathing in from there as well, it could be really, really bad news. And in many instances, you can smell the acridity of some of these sort of situations. So it remains a major waste management challenge. And we've been speaking to our waste management colleagues around emission standards for air as well, which we believe should support amongst their licensing in terms of these lands. The aspect around the aerial spraying and pesticide spraying, there is law. But it's one of those laws, once again, that is administered by a department which has got, I'm not sure, I need a diplomatic whether I sort of should play a sort of an internal conflict. But the laws fall within the Department of Agriculture. So the situation is that agriculture, of course, supports the use of pesticides and what have you, but then they also regulate the use of pesticides. And so it's kind of a fox guarding the hen house situation. But there are legislation. And in actual fact, I mean, there's legislation around wind drift. So in other words, the planes are only allowed to do crop spraying under certain wind conditions where there is no wind drift. The same thing with tractor spraying of pesticides. And some of these pesticides are very nasty. There is no doubt some of these pesticides are very nasty. So therefore, the farmer is only allowed to spray under certain wind conditions so that the pesticide sprays up, falls in the crop, and then drops. This whole idea that they do it in wind and it suddenly just starts drifting into communities and stuff like that is completely unacceptable. But of course, I mean, it's the same department that does the agriculture and does the monitoring as well. So when the farmer speaks to the Department of Agriculture, they say, you know, well, you know, we've got a crop coming in, and there's a bug here, and we need to spray now, and it's So there's potential internal conflict, but just to assure you that there are actually legislation in place to control that. And if you see it, you need to report it to the Department of Agriculture. Then the aspect around, do we have the capacity to do advisory, specifically on small industries as well? We don't have the standing capacity. So in other words, I could never have a situation where somebody is a referral agency. But however, in terms of our specialist posts, we have three specialist posts, which is a very strange thing for a government department, because the usual thing of government departments is that you employ good technicians. And if the technicians get better and better and they become really, really excellent, you either lose them to industry or you lose them to management. Because the only way that you can actually push a technician and keep them in the hierarchy is to start making them a manager. And what often happens is you turn an excellent technician into an exceptionally poor manager. You know, so suddenly you've got a scientist who knows everything about chemistry, who now becomes a director who knows nothing about management. And because they know nothing about management, all they do is micromanage, because they only do the work that they know. So basically what they do is they start doing the work of their own staff around chemistry, and they forget about financial management, strategic planning, operating, controlling. And of course this is hugely problematic. So what we try to do is try to develop a class of posts where we can actually provide a place for technicians to go and increase their technical capacity without getting involved in management. And these are called the specialist advisor posts, and we have three of them. But they're also on limited contracts, because we want to recycle them. We don't want to get a whole bunch of old men or women sitting in the thing for years and years and years. We want to get new blood through this thing as well. So it'll be a 3-year contract, and they're specialists. I mean, these are people that are sort of PhD level. And the first one is around air quality planning and modeling, which is a scientific aspect around the use of these models. The next one is what we call risk management, but it's actually around epidemiology and toxicology. So it's the whole aspect of the chemistry of toxicity of pollutants, and epidemiology is the study of disease. And then the third one is an industrial process engineer. So somebody at the PhD level who is an industrial process engineer that can give advice on industrial processes. And the strategic advantage of that is not to provide the industries with support, but to provide us with support in our discussions with industry. Because you can imagine if we go to an industry and say, we want you to be cleaner, and the industry turns to us and say, you can't be cleaner, this is the best way you can do it. And of course, they're the experts. We want an expert on our team to sort of say, that's rubbish. We know that you can do this, and this is the example. But with that kind of level of expertise as well, it means that we would then have the capacity to actually do some kind of assistance. However, the best place, we've had a recent meeting, there was a bilateral between the DGs of our department and Department of Trade and Industry. In fact, just last week. And specifically was the whole aspect of cooperation around cleaner production. And as you may be aware, the Department of Trade and Industry actually have a cleaner production center, which is exactly that. It's a referral center for industry. So if you're a small developer and what have you, you go to the cleaner production center. First of all, you get advice on what the law requires, and then you get technical advice on the kind of equipment and technologies that you can use. So that center exists, and I'm hoping that we'll have further cooperation but from our side in the area, once we have the expertise that we can also provide to that center. So that exists, and that capacity is there. The aspect about fly ash, which is the ash first of all, you get the ash that's taken out of the chimneys from the electrostatic precipitators as well, and then the bottom ash from the actual turbines themselves. Now, and you're right, a huge amount of this stuff is produced, and by its very nature, it is extremely fine-grained. And with fine-grain, it means that it's easily dispersed by air. Also, fine-grain, just to keep it moist, because of the huge surface area of each of the particles, it uses huge amounts of water to bed it down. So it's a real problem area. However, they're now turning into bricks. So it's a waste stream that has now been turned into bricks. And because not only is it a problem that, it also contains heavy metals.
like mercury, lead, and other forms, but they want to trace things. I mean, what if it's a brick, for instance, it would be an immobilized site. But by blowing around and what have you, we're having major pollution from these kind of heavy metals too. However, the brick manufactured from fly ash is a really small component. So if you have a fly ash dump, this brick manufacturer just eating at the edge of this whole situation. So there is, I mean, it is a major challenge, and it's a waste management challenge. And it's a waste management challenge that at the moment falls within. The other aspect, though, which is a very, very interesting one, it's the discussions that we're having around Eskom around new coal-fired power stations, the ones that are on the drawing board. One of the ones that they're planning is in Witbank. And Witbank, of course, is a priority area for air pollution. It's already a problem. And we made it quite clear that we would not accept a power station without proper flue gas desulfurization, the proper plant to actually pull out the sulfur out of those stacks, which is expensive. But if we have to do this, I mean, we have a sulfur problem already. The beauty of flue gas desulfurization is a very simple process where you add lime to smoke coming out of the stack. And the waste product, spray water and lime, the waste product that comes out is gypsum, sealing material. That's the waste product from the pollution control device. So we've had discussions with Eskom a lot about looking at downstream industry, the creation of a gypsum manufacturing sector to use the waste product from sulfur reduction, and then the government intervention around retrofitting ceilings with low-cost homes. Then we start killing two birds with one stone. First of all, putting ceilings in is an energy efficiency intervention. And we're using a waste product that is cleaning up the air. So that's the kind of stuff that we're hoping to do. And then we're asking, do we do actual stuff? And that's the kind of actual stuff that makes a huge difference. And that's the kind of work that we're hoping to do, and we're discussing with Eskom. The tree planting work, you're absolutely correct. I mean, some years ago, there were a number of well-meaning NGOs that started tree planting activities in Soweto specifically. And I remember one of them, because I went to one of the launches of one, where a whole bunch of middle-class whitey went into the forest and started planting trees, without even speaking to the people. The trees were planted in people's driveways, planted in places where people park, or where people would normally have a street-side shop. And the trees were all destroyed, for good reason. No one actually was involved in where they were planted. It was a complete disaster and a complete waste of time. It was a good photographic opportunity. But there was nothing in place about watering these things or care or maintenance, and there certainly wasn't any local ownership. It was a failure. But now it's changed. It's dramatically changed. As you correctly say, I mean, Soweto is being greened. And as part of the 2010 process, as you may know, 1 million trees are now being planted for Soweto. In other words, they're already planted. They're not in Soweto yet, because they're only planting the big trees. Because the small ones have a far limited source of survival. So all the Johannesburg nurseries are planting trees. And they're sitting there, and the nurseries are big trees. And before the World Cup, suddenly there'll be these big trees that will just suddenly appear on the streets of Soweto, and a million of them. So there's some really good interventions that are coming up. People are thinking about this, and it'll make a huge difference to people's lives. The reality, of course, is that by creating these kind of urban forests, you actually start changing the weather. You start getting more rain. Mm. So more things grow. So it's almost a self-perpetuation. The more trees you have, the more precipitation you get, the easier they grow, the bigger the trees grow, and what have you. If the area looks like a desert, it will remain like a desert. The other aspect in terms of town planning, which is always something I'm sure you've noticed this as well, is that in terms of new housing development, you'll see a pristine piece of land sitting there, and the first thing that happens before the houses are built are the bulldozers come through. Yeah. And then it's flat in the area. Yeah. So every single tree or nice geographical feature like a rock outcrop, it could be a rockery or something like that, everything is just flattened into what looks like a football field, and then 3,000 houses are built. To actually do land clearing that actually preserves existing trees and what have you, and big trees and stuff like that, is really not difficult. As a civil engineer who's been building roads for years, it's very, very easy to do. It's just that our mindset is that we get onto people's land,
We want to pull 3,000 houses, we just pull over the area flat and easy to do. Mm. But there are ways and means, and I think if we start empowering communities, it's to say this, that, you know, okay, if you're building our houses, but don't chop down all the trees. We want our house built with the trees here. You know? So there are a number of ways that we can start looking at these sort of situations and interventions. And certainly with our work around the Bar Triangle and now in the High Spot as well, we've been speaking to councillors and telling councillors that when they start this development, this is the kind of thing that they need to speak about. And we found an exceptionally positive response from councillors. Because it just makes good sense. The Orlando Power Station, I've heard no updates about whether that's going to be demothballed. I'm not even sure that it can, to be honest. But if it could, it falls much the same situation as the Calvin Power Station. Calvin Power Station falls within Ekurhuleni municipality. So it pollutes Ekurhuleni, but it actually belongs to Johannesburg. So it's typical of power generation, is that you put your power station that pollutes somebody else, but you use electricity someplace else. And it's true. I mean, the people of the Western Cape, for instance, they don't care about air pollution in the high salt. And yet, every time we put the light up here, we're creating air pollution in the high salt. So the whole thing of displacement of pollution, when we get a product at the end, but we forget about the pollution, is an important one. But the biggest sadness around Orlando, first of all, if Orlando was ever retrofitted to work again, it would have to meet new emission standards. So it would be clean. But there would be other aspects that would have to be looked at as well. Is that Orlando's cooling towers were basically steam was pouring out of those towers as well, which of course is not harmful, but it's just a waste of energy. Especially when you've got the world's largest hospital right next door, and just the university was right next door too. All of them have their own boilers. So in other words, they're also burning coal to heat them. The whole idea of a combined heat and power situation, if Orlando was started again, to create a pipeline between the power station and the hospital to provide the hospital with all its steam requirements rather than wasting it to the air, is an energy efficiency intervention, which would reduce the cost of energy from that area and certainly reduce the cost of energy for the hospital and the schools and public areas around that area. Then the next thing is that Soweto is connected to the grid. So if Orlando Power Station runs, the people in Soweto will be using Orlando Power Station electricity. So that's the way it'll run. But I haven't heard of any new plan for Orlando, and certainly we've not been approached in terms of the refurbishment of Orlando Power Station. The comment around greening, and certainly the greening of settler schools. Mondi is a paper company that grows trees. It should be their responsibility to start planting trees in settler schools. I would agree with you entirely. The final question around, is it possible for class action against government or companies? Absolutely. The law provides for exactly that. The unfortunate thing around air pollution is that it's not easy. And I'll give you an example. In 1997, I think, the Legal Resources Center, which is an NGO that supports class action in these sort of situations, was given a large amount of Danish funding. And I know this because I was a Danish funder at that time. Specifically to start looking at investigating class actions around air pollution. But it's so technically difficult to prove that it's this emission from this company that has caused this problem. Yeah. That they're never successful in court. So the easiest way to do is have a license. This is what you're allowed to do. And if you don't do that, then there's an offence. And therefore it's easy. You can say, we allowed you to do this, this is what you actually did, you got a call. But to try and prove that the pollution coming out of a stack has actually caused a cancer or a cough in somebody is really, really difficult. It can be done, but with a huge expense. The class actions around air pollution often fail. They start off with the best intentions, and the law provides for exactly that to happen. But they don't stand up. In terms of taking government to court, the kind of precedent that we have, even despite the Grootboom case around housing, the situation is that even within the Constitutional Court, we're likely to say that, for instance, government seems to be doing as much as it possibly can. It looks as if it's practically doing a lot of work. And can we hold the current government responsible for And the answer would be, no, we're not ready. So if the current government is doing enough to actually start improving on the situation, then the Constitutional Court is going to say, well, this is a progressive realization of the rights. Because in the Constitutional Court, you'd never have a situation that says, when the new act comes into effect, suddenly the sky turns blue. It just doesn't. That's not practical. But if government is taking the steps to actually make the sky bluer, then that would be seen as a fair government, and therefore would not be permissible in court. But that's a layperson's opinion, based on some historical precedent.
Thank you. I saw the very last hand, Manzanga, will take that one and then we'll try that one.
Thank you. You know, if you have been waiting for 50 years, more than 50 years like myself, you know the kind of harm that was brought to our house by that power station in Orlando for all those years. Because really, we tried, even if people tried to speak to the authorities about that pollution, every morning it was pitch black. And towards the evening, every night, when you go to work, it was pitch black. In the evening, it was pitch black again. But that power station did not give us any energy. It was, that energy was going to other people. Now, when we spoke to the authorities about the harm that is being brought to bear about that power station, our pleas fell on deaf ears. Like you are saying now that it's difficult to prove that a kind of a disease that is brought in by pollution, by those that power station. But to us, it was a reality because it went on and on, and then there was a hospital built, a funder, built in just near Baragwana. And within a few months, in Kuwait, during that time, we had mobile X-ray units that went from school to school to examine children for chest problems. If it was harmless, that smoke was harmless, how come that we could get authorities bringing in X-rays to come and examine children, and why build the center in Soweto when there are so many places? Why not in Santa? Huh? Why not in any other rich area? They brought it to Soweto where they knew that it was causing harm to small children and elderly people. But just as you say that you cannot prove it, the authorities did say the same thing, because they've never stayed in Soweto, and I have stayed in Soweto for 50 years.
Okay, thanks, Manzanga. I suppose that was more or less a comment. We would like to thank you once more for your presentation, and that brings us to an end of our session.
Are we going to do this the whole month? Job, please. Empty.